Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters-Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast. And today we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Randy Woodley, who is the co-founder with his wife, Edith, of the Elohe Indigenous Center for Earth Justice, where together they invite people to a new relationship with creation and model sustainable farming practices and earth justice. He earned a PhD in intercultural studies and currently serves as distinguished professor of faith and culture at Portland Seminary in Portland, Oregon. And Dr. Woodley is recognized as a Cherokee descendant by the United Kituwa Band of Cherokee Indians, and he's the author of several books, including Shalom and the Community of Creation, and his newest book, which is our featured book for the month, which is Becoming Rooted, 100 Days of Reconnecting with Sacred Earth, which was published by Broadleaf Books and just brand new. So welcome, Randy. It's really wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you both. Good to be here. The book's just out, but it's out in more ways than one. It sold out in the first 3 weeks.
Oh, and, fantastic.
So we got about another week and a half and they'll do a second shipment. So.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I'm so excited to hear the hunger for this. So as we get started, maybe you can tell us a little bit about why you wrote this particular book at this particular moment in time. Obviously, you're touching into something, a hunger that people have.
Yeah, happy to do that. So my wife and I are, like I said, at Elohe Indigenous Center for Earth Justice and Elohe Farm and Seeds. And so part of our whole project, if you will, our life's goal is to help us to shed ourselves of this dangerous Western worldview and to help us to find a more indigenous worldview with more indigenous values. And so most times I address that sort of head on. Through different vehicles, theology and philosophy and things, but I wanted also to invite anyone who's on this earth to find a sense of spirituality and sometimes refine a sense of spirituality again with their connection with earth. And so I thought, you know, maybe just some very short bite-sized exercises and reflections each day. If somebody could sort of follow me with that for 100 days at the most, probably less. Most people can't do 100 days, but they can use it as sort of pick and choose. And maybe if they could see from at least one indigenous perspective, that it might bring them closer to converting them, literally converting them to a more indigenous worldview, because the Western worldview has gotten us in all the trouble that we're in now in so many fronts, and it's not going to sustain our future. And so our indigenous people have been living with the land for so long and have learned over time how to live with the land. And so there's still much to learn in the greater society.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a perfectly timely book. Claudia, do you want to kind of jump us off?
Yeah. Randy, you mentioned that you began to practice a more indigenous lifestyle in your 20s. What kind of support did you have for that? And how were you able to sustain it?
Yeah. So in my 20s, well, when I was a very young person, so both my parents are mixed blood Cherokees, who were fully assimilated into white society. And you know, I would sit around all their friends who were also mixed blood Shawnees and Creeks and other tribes. And they'd all talk about sort of like this romantic idea of, you know, like their grandmother spoke, you know, the language, and their parents didn't teach it to them, and, you know, all these kinds of things. And I kind of decided, sitting around those gatherings, that, well, that's not the kind of Indian I want to be. So I sort of set a path for myself, and then just decided, you know, hey, I need to find my own family tree and sort of figure out who's who and what's going on. And then I need to begin to act on that. And so over the years, I sort of had my ups and downs. When I first converted to follow Jesus, there was a lot of, you know, legalism that crept in. You need to cut your hair. Don't worry about all this Indian stuff. Take all those Indian posters down from your room, and just, you know, that's all of the quote unquote flesh, and just be like us, right? Which is basically assimilate into whiteness. And so I tried that for a couple of years, and it didn't really work. And so kind of got back up, found my way back in. That was the 20s. And continued to just sort of seek my life's direction in Indian country. And, you know, I ended up being involved in a lot of different things over the years. So, of course, marrying a woman. My wife, Edith, is Eastern Shoshone, Choctaw, and Paiute, and several other tribes, but raised on the reservation. And we met, married, and just our life serving Native people from that point on just took us all over the United States and Canada, mentoring and helping. And we've done everything, every sort of service available, I think, in Indian country, because the government and the churches have done such a poor job. I mean, their goal was to make our people to make them dependent, and which takes away your dignity, right? And so our goal then was to begin to try and create more agency for our indigenous family. And yeah, and so that's how we kind of got into this, and kind of the path we've been on. A lot of that has to do with, you know, we start in our local earth. We start in the community of creation around us, and that's part of why we do what we do. But we also realized along the way that it wasn't just for our indigenous family to decolonize and indigenize, but we needed to heal together. And so that's when we began to also, I wouldn't say we reached out, I'd just say that we got so many invitations that we began to accommodate non-Native folks who were interested in the same thing. And we realized, yeah, we've all got to do this together. We're all on this planet together. If we're going to change evil systems and create better systems, then we've got to do it together. So that's sort of where we are now.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's really powerful work. And in the very beginning of your book, you talk about this quote that you said, that, you know, we're all indigenous to some place. Your ancestors were at one time all indigenous, your parents, grandparents, great parents, great grandparents who loved and breathed and experienced life before you. They are now living through you. Really beautiful imagery of them looking, the generations looking back and looking forward. And that their indigeneity matter because you're here now as their living hope. So I love this image and this call to each of us to reclaim our own indigenous roots, whatever those might be. And so I just wonder if you could speak more to that, and particularly, you know, how you see this helping to heal both those of us who have, you know, colonizer and settler, you know, ancestors, and those who've been colonized. How do we live out this hope that you describe that we all carry within us through this practice?
Yeah. So this the hope of the colonizer, besides robbing lands and extracting what they can to make money or gain power, or, you know, even as simple as feed your people. When you've misused the land for so long, you have to go find other lands and resources to keep everybody fed. And so that's been the case with a lot of empires like Great Britain, for example. So they misused the land. They cut down most of their oak forests and they despoiled their bays and rivers. And all this was happening right at the time of what people refer to as quote unquote discovery. And so, so now 500 years later, they've done it to us in our land. Mm-hmm. And which goes to prove that there's a worldview problem. That's the consistent thing that that turns people to that. And I'm sorry, I forgot your question because I kind of saw myself back in England and looking at what they were about and what we're about. So I got distracted. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Just, you know, to talk a little bit more about how this heals both those who are have colonized our ancestry as well as colonized, and how that helps us to live out that hope that you described.
Yeah. So, so we know from the past that the Western worldview is not going to sustain our future. I mean, it's just not. It's been proven time and time again. And so what do we have to do? We have to change. And in the old days, anthropologists and others would say worldviews are what they would call immutable, right? That they can't be changed. Mm-hmm. But we know that's absolutely false. And I just, having been married for almost 33 years now, I can tell you that my wife and I were taught in two different worldviews as male and female. Mm-hmm. And women have almost always been able to see from two worldviews in order to make it, you know? And so to me, this was a simple thing of, no, we can convert people from a Western worldview. It takes a little bit, right? But what we found along the way is that once people start to see it, it's kind of like that tapestry. Once you start pulling on one thread, the whole thing starts coming apart. And that's the way it is with the colonial powers and the colonial systems, that they're meant to make everybody, quote unquote, in this country, an American, right? And so you forget your Irish, you forget your Polish, you forget, you know, et cetera. And the job is to become an American. Well, the problem is that that's not America's identity. America's identity is much more complex than that. And we shouldn't have to erase who we are and who our ancestors were, just to become an American. In fact, you know, the diversity principle, which is a, you know, very sort of natural thing that happens everywhere in nature, except for humans try to fight that sometimes. But this idea of diversity always makes for something stronger. And so it does in nature and it does in humans. So rather than try to amalgamate everyone into being, and by the way, there are some people who can never be American enough for that standard. Black folks can never be enough for that standard. Native folks can never be enough for that standard. Asians can never be enough for that standard. Brown Hispanics can never be enough for that standard. And so it's sort of like they dangle out this myth called the American dream, but then the truth is that you really can never reach it. And so so that's sort of the negative side of that. And if people are going to heal, they need to come back to who they are. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to find their identity and their ancestors, but I just believe strongly over the years, I've seen so many people sort of going back and finding a spirituality from their ancestors. You know, there's a saying in Indian country, it says, you know, we are the descendants of our ancestors and the ancestors of our descendants. And there's this sort of unbroken link. And as we look back on wherever we're from, and I have as mixed a background as anybody in America, it dishonors those people by neglecting who they were and their culture and what they were about. And so, you know, it doesn't mean that any of them, there was no utopia, there was nothing perfect, but we are who we are. And when a colonizing force tries to change that, they're robbing us of our own identity. And so, and then there's also this thing about being on host people's lands, right? So one of the wonderful myths that is starting to be disproven in this country is the idea we had this lost, quote unquote, lost colony called Roanoke, right? So we had in our country, we had the the Boston colony, the Puritans, and we had the Pilgrims in Plymouth, and we had the Jamestown people. And people forget that before all of that, there was a quote unquote Roanoke colony. And what we're finding out now is that they assimilated into the indigenous people there. And those people are still around now. They're called the Lumbees. And so there's another model that we can look at rather than coming in and trying to like make everybody like England and then calling them Americans. We actually can honor the host people of the land and their traditions and their understandings and respect those and respect especially the values that they have and the things that those people are still fighting for now. So our identity also has to, if it's to come from the land we're on as well, then we also need to be respectful and cognizant of the histories and current state of the indigenous people from that land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. It's like we have to live with kind of multiple awarenesses of our own ancestors and our own indigeneity, but then the land that we're on and respecting the people that, you know, were the original inhabitants. And also, because, you know, the book is all about becoming rooted in the place that you are. So I love that you hold that kind of multiple layers of identity.
Well, diversity is a beautiful thing. I mean, and like I said, in nature, it strengthens everything, right? So it's, you know, my life was we were chatting just a bit, you know, with Claudia and I were chatting a little bit about our common roots of where we're from originally, Detroit and Ypsilanti, Willow Run, Michigan. And one of the things that was so wonderful to me was to, I grew up in a place, my particular neighborhood was sort of a kind of in the middle of everybody else. And it was as mixed as it would get back in the 50s and 60s, right? So we had some quote unquote interracial couples. We had Hawaiians, we had Native Americans, we had a Mexican family, we had a Jewish family, and that was my neighborhood. Now, just on the other side of me was on down the road was a wealthier white neighborhood. And then on another side was a very poor, poor white neighborhood. And then just north of me was an extremely poor black neighborhood, the projects. And then just on another side of me was middle-class black folks. And so that sort of that geography itself, it explains my life and my exposure from the time I was a child to say that, you know, there's beauty in all of these cultures and peoples and religions and things. And so I guess I that stuck with me and it's been, you know, one of my passions.
Beautiful. Yeah.
I could see all of those places that you mentioned. I want to ask you about Genesis 1:28. I'm going to read from the New King James Version. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." What are your thoughts on this verse?
Yeah, well, I have a whole lot of thoughts. I don't know if we have time for them all on that verse. But what I would like to say, first of all, is that in that story is the recipe for diversity, since we've been talking about it, right? You're fruitful, you multiply, you fill the earth. And of course, people's languages change over time, their cultures change over time. It adapts to the both climate and the land and the whole community of creation. And so in that is really the first idea about in that story is what it means to have a diverse world. But when we talk about subdue and have dominion, those words are really not the correct words that need to be there. And some people have said stewardship, but I think I had a graduate student who spent a whole term paper on those terms. And what he came up with was the best English equivalent of the text is co-sustainers. to be co-sustainers with God and co-sustainers with the rest of the community of creation. And that in that verse, in those first, that first chapter of Genesis, is our marching orders, if you will, of what it means to be a human being. Our role as human beings, created last, not because, you know, we are something really special and glorious and the head of creation and everything else is under us. No, created last because we're the only ones equipped to co-sustain creation, the rest of creation. And so that's what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. And to me, to be human is to be spiritual. Our role is human beings and taking care of the earth and the whole community of creation, our getting our hands in the dirt, literally, and making the earth have abundance and having peace between one another, what we call our native harmony way, or what the Bible you're talking about is called shalom, is our basic commandment to be human and to be spiritual. Let's let creator be creator, and we'll be human, and we'll fulfill our role, and that's our own spirituality.
Mm.
I'm sorry. I wanted to say that one word makes such a difference in how you frame that whole idea. Thank you.
Yeah, and there's been a number of dissertations and now books that are being written correcting that language. But, you know, in a hierarchical European, platonically dualistic society, you know, that worked well. You've got to have dominion over everything, right? It's about a misuse of power.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I wonder, you have a couple of beautiful images in your book, and one of them is what you call the original instructions, and that you believe that all humans desire to live according to these original instructions. So is this harmony way kind of how you understand what those original instructions are about, and how does one reconnect from that because we are so clearly deeply disconnected? And I would say some people would have no desire to go back, you know, to that way, or acknowledge that that was even a reality for them.
Well, this really started on a pilgrimage, if you will. I was a guide. I was one of two guides on a month-long pilgrimage that a group called Inner Varsity did. Mm-hmm. It was called Pilgrimage for Reconciliation. And we studied Shalom for a week in Atlanta. And then I led them for 2 weeks on the Cherokee Trail of Tears. And then we did 2 weeks on the Civil Rights Freedom Trail. And we basically looked at where Shalom had been broken the most in our country and some of the major places. And so during that first year, I did it for 2 years. I was a guide for the Trail of Tears portion for 2 years. But during that first week, as these teachers, these Bible scholars began to teach about Shalom, I kept telling my wife, we have a Cherokee construct that's similar to that. And I, you know, this big picture of Shalom, right? That it's like peace and abundance on the earth, and nobody's hungry. Everybody's being fed, and, you know, that sort of a thing. Not a utopia, but mm-hmm. just a way of living that's according to values that are different than the Western worldview has. And so I left that, and that summer I began to look up Cherokee elders and talk to them. And really got the lowdown of this idea of we call it Elohe, or Diyukti is another way to put it. And it's a way of walking in harmony with everyone and everything. And it very much is similar to Shalom. And so when I did my doctoral dissertation, I did the commonalities of the values of Shalom from an Old Testament scholar named Walter Brueggemann and his understanding. Mm-hmm. And then our Native American harmony way. And so I was involved with 45 different tribes across every region of the United States and Canada. And everybody, and I interviewed 8 spiritual leaders from those different regions, language speakers, et cetera. And every single person in every single tribe understood what I was talking about immediately. This harmony way, we just call it generically a harmony way. And so that's where I really got my background from that. And then I ended up writing a book called Shalom and the Community of Creation and Indigenous Vision as a result of that. So a lot of this Shalom stuff is in there. But throughout both our Indigenous lives and ethics and values has always been taught this harmony way, this way of balance. And it also is complete in the scriptures, both Old Testament, New Testament. And actually, it's exactly what Jesus was teaching was about the word kingdom. He never used, but when people use it, they need to be using Shalom kingdom, because that's a whole different thing. And so so the core of, I think, Christianity and the core of Judaism, the core of Islam, the core of so many religions and just spiritualities is these original instructions, how to live well with others and the earth, the whole community of creation.
That's really beautiful. Yeah. And you have this other term that I also wanted to lift up, where you describe your deepest primordial spirit heart, which you talk about in the context of listening to the sound of the elk and the loon. So I just wanted to bring that in here as well, because it feels like it's connected to these original instructions that somehow, if I'm reading it correctly, the deepest primordial spirit heart is the part of us that remembers those original instructions, and that maybe is evoked by the sounds of creation when we really are listening and opening ourselves. Is that sort of along the lines of?
Yeah, you know, there's a point where words fail to express what's really going on.
Yeah.
And I think that's the closest I could get to that. And yet I think we're called to live close to that, right?
Yeah.
I think we're called to live in that vulnerability. To be vulnerable is to be human, to admit our humanness. To be vulnerable is to be spiritual. I consider the Creator to be the most vulnerable being who exists. Mm. And, you know, that's to me what I strive for, is to live in a vulnerable way, to live in an honest way, to teach from that perspective, to model that, and to help others to attain that.
Mm.
Beautiful. I want to talk about sacred sleep. And Christine and I have a question about this, but we're coming from very different perspectives. So Christine, will you ask your question first and for him to read the passage?
Sure. I would love for you to read that paragraph on the top of page 16 and just share a little bit more about sacred sleep and how those of us who try so hard to control the events in our lives can learn to soften and release into this practice.
You just want me to read that top paragraph?
Yeah, just that top paragraph. It's really, your writing is so beautiful. I thought it'd be nice to hear some of your words.
Thank you. Sleeping in the bosom of nature is not the same as sleeping in the safety of one's own home. Not at all. As you lay your body down to become one with the earth, reality shifts. In that state, you can sense that God, Creator, is listening to the intentions of your heart. Whatever the mysterious power is behind creation, it softens one's mind. Great mystery unscrews the tight lids of the jars of certainty that you hold too tightly, too fiercely. You realize sometimes, even trembling, that something greater than yourself is meeting you.
Beautiful. And then I also love the next line about the restful unknown world between sleep and wakefulness. But I wonder if you could just maybe say a little bit more about sacred sleep and how those of us who are gripping really tightly onto those jars of control, how we learn to soften that.
Yeah. So I think I started, we started a group with another, a lot of other Native folks in the United States and Canada some time ago called NAITS, North American Institute for Indigenous Theological Studies. And our first journal that we put out, I did something called Structure and Values in the Native North American Church. And what I realized in researching that, of compared to seven of our different ceremonies that were kind of pan-Indian ceremonies, that the values were opposite. one another. They were almost polar opposite. And the most obvious is that of control. The Western church, and which is a reflection of Western society, is all about control.
Yeah.
And, you know, that control is sort of what fuels the empire.
Yeah.
And it's not at all, if you're a follower of Jesus, not at all what Jesus taught. I think Jesus taught the opposite. Jesus said that the spirit is like the wind. It blows here and there, and who can control it? And so I look at our lives being like that. If we are to live our lives, then there has to be this way of letting go of all the things that sort of keep us from being human,
mm-hmm.
letting go all of the things that keep us, the walls up between us and our neighbors and us and the rest of the community of creation, and just letting go. Now, that's a dangerous thing, right? Yeah. It can be scary, but it's great practice in a society that considers control to be one of the number one virtues.
Yeah, and it's beautifully connected to what you were just saying before about vulnerability being an essential practice. That's so counter to what the dominant culture tells us is important, that to practice that is, you know, a revelation in itself.
and that control is ubiquitous. It's in all areas of society. It's in our economic system, it's in our social systems, it's in our penal systems, it's in our justice systems, in our education systems, you know, our religions, etc. And so, you know, we have to break loose from that and find the freedom that really lies in our own spirituality.
Thank you.
Randy, I am completely serious about this. I can't even imagine laying on the earth and sleeping. It wouldn't be sacred sleep for me. It would be not sacred paranoia. Because bugs, Randy, bugs. Someone told me, now I know God did not put two roaches on that ark. and I mean, really, bugs are what the barrier is between me and nature, and like all kind of bugs, and then in the ocean, it's all kind of weird things. So for someone like me who really wants to be one with nature and respect it, any advice?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first of all, you know, I lived near where you are in Kentucky, and it is muggy and buggy in the summertime. So I know what you speak of. And yet I was still able to do that out there. We had a creek, the Hickman Creek, that ran through our property. And I would sometimes lay out there. And, you know, most bugs they want to be left alone, right? That's what they're about. And so most of the time, it doesn't mean that you might not have an ant crawling on you or, you know, a fly landing on you or something like that. But I got to tell you, and maybe I shouldn't say this because everybody might want to move here, but we don't really have a problem of those kinds here in Oregon. I'm particularly prone to mosquito bites, and I think I've been bit less than 8 times in the last, 13, 14 years here. So a little secret about, you know, some of the pleasures of living in Oregon. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's a purpose for everything. Every creature on this planet has a role and a purpose. And so we have to respect that. And, you know, there are places where they're more buggy and there are places where there's not. So find one where it's not.
I'm on my way, Randy.
Yeah, we don't have too much of a problem with roaches here in Ireland either, so maybe come over for a visit. Randy, I love the essay you have called We Are Still Here, about resilience and hope, and you talk about In Indian country, any hope is good hope. This hope sustained through poverty, racism, poor housing, chronic disease, and a host of other maladies is not based on utopianism. And that's something that you kind of repeat a few times in the book, that, you know, this is like really real stuff. The earned hope of which I speak is built on a spirituality of relationship with the land. So I wonder if you could say more. One of the things that I'm loving about this book club's process of conversations with authors and with Claudia is how much people of color, you know, like the resilience, the hope, like the, you know, like the, that's, it's, it kind of, it puts me in a sense of awe. And so I wonder if you could say more about this persistent hope and how it's nourished you and your relationship to the land. What does hope look like in the midst of all the struggles that you named, you know, the poverty, the racism, the housing, the illness, all of that? How do you maintain that hope and how does it stay, you know, so strong?
So, and I would, you're in Ireland right now, and I would say the same thing for the Irish. You know, it's a common characteristics by people who have been oppressed to fight to survive, right? And you do it for your future generations, and you do it for your own dignity, and you do it for your ancestors, and you do it because hopefully, and this is one of our motivations, because you believe there can be a better world. Now, you know, I have every reason, and my wife and I, and my wife in particular, who looks much more Native than I do, and is easily identified as that when she walks in a store, and grew up on the reservation and very extremely poor. And a couple of my kids, the same thing, that who became darker, because there's a colorism involved too, right? And so, we have lots of reasons after losing everything and being, you know, basically chased out of a home that we put everything into, and losing everything, to be bitter and to give up and to, you know, and just the frustration that we've had with the white church, honestly, over all these years, and their inability to sort of take a look at themselves. There's lots of reasons to quit, lots of reasons. But, you know, I don't know. I look at my grandchildren, and I've got six grandkids, and I don't want them to have to go through all this. You know, and so what if I can help just a little bit to push this farther so that they don't have to go through as much? And then I think, yeah, I probably had some ancestors who said the same thing. And so we carry on because it's the human thing to do. It's easy to quit. And honestly, I'm not very good at quitting.
Yeah, that persistence is certainly a gift and a grace.
When talking about oppressed people and post-colonial stress syndrome, of course, African Americans would suffer from that. And we're kind of different, where our indigenous, I messed that word up. The part of us that's indigenous is in Africa, yet because of chattel slavery, our experience in America is completely different. And we were forced to work this land. It was a strange land for us. I've heard that Africans, captive Africans actually worked with indigenous Americans because they had to teach us how to work this land. So my question is, so much of African American culture, so much was erased from who we are. And we are not Africans like indigenous African people because we have the experience of chattel slavery. So how could we embrace who we are as African Americans when we actually kind of have this dual identity.
Yeah, and I think it's a similar construct with Native people. I mean, it's a different history, but there's no way that you can tell the story of African Americans in this country without Native Americans. And there's no way you can tell the story of Native Americans in this country without African Americans. And so there is a rich, rich history from all sorts of angles, some good, some bad. And then there's this intersectionality of a common oppression, right? Of white supremacy. And so I think just like, you know, people ask me, how could, like at our powwows, you'll see in our color guards, they'll have the American flag along with the tribal flags and things. And how can you guys even do that after so many, you know? So we only have one land, right? And we have this beautiful ancestry. African people have this beautiful ancestry of indigenous peoples in Africa, and a lot of things were brought over and passed on, even more caught than taught. And so it sort of makes the African American in a lot of ways as American or more American than anybody else, because that whole, it's just like the Irish American, I guess, or any other one, but they sort of had to become white in order to make it. But in Native Americans, there was something born here in America that couldn't be born anywhere else, and it couldn't be developed anywhere else. And yes, there was, you know, all these years of enslavement and Jim Crow and, you know, all the civil, you know, struggle throughout the civil rights and the even to up to Black Lives Matter now and so many other movements that are still rightfully fighting for social equity and equality. And those things make African Americans as American or more American than anybody else, because they fought harder for the ideas of America, which is, you know, that's the thing that you can always hold up and say, do we really believe in social equity? Do we really believe in freedom? Do we really believe in democracy? If we did, we wouldn't have such a hard time changing it to a more democratic and free system. And so to me, Native Americans and African Americans have fought in every war to defend this country, every foreign war. The inventions, the innovation and everything from African Americans and Native Americans too, you know, so many, so much rich history there is to be that can't be removed from the land itself, because the land also creates people. And I have to think, like when I think about enslaved Africans in America, yes, it was horrendous. Yes, it was like, it was beyond horrendous, beyond what we can imagine. But I also think that there had to be times when, as they were watching things grow, that same spirit that was in them and their ancestors from Africa, of this connection to the land, is there. Now, one of the things that separated African Americans and others of all kinds from the land is urbanization. We live in this sort of urban societies. There was the Great Migration, you know, of the 50s, and so many, mostly African American, but also poor whites and also poor natives and other folks moved up to the industrialized cities. And then the urban centers became sort of a place of reality, but that's not our reality. Those are manufactured realities. All that concrete and all those buildings, those are the things that human beings can do. And if they're good things, we should be proud. If they're bad, we could be ashamed. But the Creator made all this world for us to enjoy. And so I think it's an unnatural way of thinking and being when we say that that we can't connect with the outdoors. And I think that's part of, you know, some people have said, you know, you're giving people permission to love the earth again. And I'm like, okay, well, if people need permission, that's okay. But it happens. And you know, right now there's a big movement of African-American farmers throughout the whole United States. Not that there hasn't always been African-American farmers. I mean, that's like some of the best farmers in the whole land. But there's people like Soul Fire Farm, for example, Leah Penniman and others who have reconnected with those roots. And so I just encourage African-American people and all peoples to reconnect with that. We're all, you know, being indigenous means that we lived with the land, not on the land, not extracting from the land, but living with the land and knowing how it operates. And that's what we need to get back to. And I, you know, that's a long answer for, and I may not have answered that question in a good way, but that's just my thoughts on it.
I think that was a great answer. My family is actually from Kentucky, Middlesboro, Kentucky. And of course, in the Great Migration, they moved to Detroit to work in the auto plants. I found myself here for a completely different reason, but I want to stay here because my family, I've got ancestors from Middlesboro that did, you know how to use herbal medicine, and some of them were part of even the hoodoo tradition. So I totally get what you're saying. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
We're coming towards the end of our time, but I want to make sure to ask this question because you talk about on page 84, you call for action. You say confessions of wrongs done to Indigenous peoples around the world must include acts of restitution, restoration, and empowerment. And then you go on to say that Indigenous peoples should not only be shown special care, but restored as the West's primary moral teachers, which I think is a beautiful call to action. And I wonder, you know, do you see how this might happen? How can we, you know, those of us who are really sympathetic to this way of being and really want to nurture it, and I completely agree with you. So how do we help to center, you know, the wisdom of Indigenous people and help to restore them to being the West's primary moral teachers?
Yeah. So this is, of course, got to happen personally and structurally, right? For effective change to happen. And one of the things we have to do structurally is to hold our leaders accountable, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not Roman Catholic, but when the Pope came out with Laudato Si, he didn't speak strongly enough about Indigenous peoples and empowering Indigenous people. You know, he talked about their relationship and all that. Well, why? If they have that kind of relationship, then they should be put in positions where they can influence committees and all these other things. But he didn't do that. And he's one person with a sort of a wave of his hand could have done that. And I wrote a letter, by the way, to the Pope as a in the Huffington Post, an open letter complaining about that. But, you know, we've got political leaders, we've got religious leaders, and we've got to hold them accountable and keep pushing them, or else find new leaders. And then on a civic level, locally, you know, who are the tribes? Who are their agents of cultural change and cultural stability? Are we inviting them to city planning meetings? And, you know, no, because there's a different agenda in a capitalist society. That's the most important thing, is making short-term money. Mm-hmm. So we then have to, we have to not only influence, but we have to become city planners. And when I speak to young people, I tell them, you need to be mayors, you need to be council people, school board members, you need to be urban rangers in parks. You need to bring this perspective to all these different levels of society so that you can make the changes possible. I've presented to, I have a whole thing called Indigenous Design for urban centers and other places. And I presented that to a group in Portland of city planners and stuff. But the bottom line is they said, we're never going to take a contract that's not the cheapest short term. And so we have to change. If they're not going to do that, then you change the people who make those decisions. A lot of groups have done a lot to move forward. And basically what I talk about is when you start to decolonize and challenge this Western worldview, you take on different values. You begin to say, oh, there are better values that will sustain us. And so there's a long process of education, and you need to find indigenous guides, people who can help along the way with that. That's, you know, there's ways to do that. And then there needs to be really like speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, reparations, restorations, reconciliation, and then what I call memorializing those things that happen, that when you make progress, put it in stone for everybody to see, because it's those things that tell the myths of America. And there's nothing stronger than myths that people live by. That's the deepest religion held in the world.
Yeah, beautiful. That's great. Oh, thank you, Randy. Claudia, was there anything else you wanted to ask before we close our time? Or
no, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much, Randy.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. We really
thank
appreciate
you both
it.
For inviting me. I look forward to telling my friends about this.